All right, here we are live for the Burning Platform on a Thursday morning. Right here on the podcast party, we're joined by Pumi Mashiko. Pumi, my sound okay? You looked a little concerned there for a minute.
I'm still concerned with the sound, but let's hear what the listeners have to say. I'm still a little concerned. Bitcoin Pete is also saying there's definitely distortion coming through, a little bit of
pumminess. I'm trying to see what the problem might be. Is that Linda? Hello, hello, hello.
Robot voice.
Robot voice. It's got robot voice, huh?
Mm-hmm.
No? Nothing. That's so bizarre. Wonder why.
Just try to let him come back in. AI. Shall we just computer love?
I wonder what it's doing, because it was absolutely fine just yesterday. I don't know what the problem is here. God damn it. All right. Well,
that's it. You should come back to the studio immediately.
I think that's the plan. Yeah. I don't know why we did this the whole way through lockdown. We were fine, so I don't know what the problem is. Okay, let me see if I can get this right in some way, shape, or form. I don't want any distortion. Still no improvement.
Jack is coming in here, and I think he's going to try and help us. Maybe in the meantime, we should let... So this is going to be a fantastic little Burning Platform because we've got two Gareths. Gareth C and Garen van Onselen.
That is so confusing.
You must just... If I say Gareth and I'm looking in your eyes, then I'm talking to you, okay? Just...
I'll try to know what you mean. Okay, somebody says, Gareth, your voice is sounding terrible. It sounds like a robot voice filter. I wonder if I should reset this whole thing. Let me see if that's maybe going to sort it out.
I think it's something he has to fix at his place.
All right, let me just see. Maybe I can sort this out. Processing. How about that? Better now?
No.
That is...
I've switched everything off of the desk here. It's very weird.
Everything on and off. We've already tried that, Carla. That's the first. It's always the first thing to do when you're having like any kind of technical issues. Just switch everything off, exactly. Breathe deeply, and start again.
All right. Well, I'm gonna try one more time, and then otherwise I'm just gonna use the mic.
And we're gonna let Jack play his little. Jack, what is that elevator music that you play at the beginning of the Burning Platform now?
It's mood music.
It's mood music.
Yeah.
Is that the mood we're trying to get people in? The mood of the bird, that is not the mood of the Burning Platform. The mood of the Burning Platform should be like...
No. No. It sets a nice precedent.
Still no improvement on your side there, Jack.
I don't wake up at the crack of dawn to come here and chill.
I know.
I actually come here with my matches in the hand. No, I don't come with matches. I come calmly. I have a cup of coffee. And then depending on the mood, that's how it all goes down.
Okay. Let me do this.
Now we've got an echo.
That's even worse.
Jarr.
Still no improvement?
Gareth, we're going to leave you off. And Gareth C, we're going to leave you off and we're going to bring the other Gareth on and see how he sounds while you get your act together, young man.
Yeah, this is like the first meeting of the GNU cabinet, I think.
No, and this is today. Today is the first cabinet Lekotla.
Oh, really? And oh, yes, that's right. It is, yeah.
What do you mean, oh, really? Gareth, the only reason we bring you on here is because we assume that you've been watching and you've been listening and you've been... reading up and doing all of the interesting and exciting things, and you're going to come here and tell us what the Lekgotla is going to, like, what's on the agenda for the Lekgotla, or what you think should be on the agenda for the Lekgotla. Let's start with that.
Yeah, geez, that's That's a biggie. I think that, you know, the first of all of these kind of meetings are kind of a get to know each other sort of thing. So I'm not sure how many hard decisions are going to emerge out of this. I mean, the one thing that a lot of parties will and a lot of ministries will be primarily concerned about is that their budgets votes are coming up and they need to obviously have clarity on what's agreed to in that. And that's a big thing because that defines not just, you know, the next year, but sometimes, you know, 3 or 5 year cycles. And a lot of that will be predetermined. A lot of the new ministers will inherit programs and budget allocations that are decided already, and there's very little time for them to be able to adjust that. But I'm not sure that that's the kind of fight that would take place in a Lekgotla. That's probably ongoing already with departments. And I'm not sure how much room they have to maneuver, given how short a period is from their induction to the budget vote. But yeah, I suspect these first things, and it's not just nationally. I mean, I think every provincial government has these kind of hospirats at the beginning of a new administration to kind of set the agenda, determine what the vision is, get to know everyone, welcome people to their new portfolios. And I suspect that'll be a good emphasis, is kind of building a sort of, well, hopefully a constructive, you know, work environment and culture so that people can get along.
Well, for the first time coming around that table. At the
right.
Welcome
here.
Back, Gareth.
Can you hear me now?
Look at that. Your
Pums, now
match.
I can't hear you for some reason. I heard Gareth perfectly. I don't know what's going on.
Jack just walked out.
Right. Gareth, that is not the Gareth I wanted to hear. I mean, like, I've been following you on Twitter, on X, for the last couple of weeks, and you have been on fire. I mean, my God, you've been laying it out. Basically just attacking and defending and fighting, and it's been war watching you on X. It's been hilarious and at the same time quite sort of jarring, because you have a lot to say about the EFF and MK, and we'll probably get into that just now. A lot to say about the government of national unity and the ministers that have been chosen and whether or not they're the right ones, and how the DA has played this game and how Cyril's played this game. So, I mean, I wanted a little bit of that fire too this morning, and I'm sure you have it in you. You're just being polite. Pumi said last week that Cyril is the big winner in this GNU and in this overall, what do we call it? This administration that we find ourselves part of now in South Africa. Do you think Cyril's the big winner? Do you think he's the one who's played the game the cleverest? He's brought everyone into the tent, and now there's less blame if it doesn't work, and there's more people that he can rely on if he needs to exercise soft power.
Ah, Gareth, I can see you trying to provoke me into something more patriotic. Yes, that's true. I have actually been having a full go at the EFF, and yeah, primarily them, actually, because they've been behaving appallingly on Twitter. So I thought they deserved some fight back. But yeah, I mean, one must differentiate between your kind of what you say on Twitter, which, you know, you need to make your point pretty strongly there to be heard, as opposed to actual political analysis, which needs to be a bit more measured and honest and objective. But I mean, as regards Ramaphosa, yeah, there seem to be two camps of thought. The one is that he was a massive winner and this was a strategic masterstroke. And, you know, papers like the Mail and Guardian had headlines like the master cabinet worker and stuff. And yeah, I mean, there is zero proof for that as of yet. First of all, there's the big picture. I mean, the ANC has done nothing but lose for the last 5 years under Ramaphosa. Lost control of the state, lost a majority. He's lost an internal majority inside the party, you know, lost control of a number of additional provinces, gone backwards by 17%. And so to kind of paint this guy as a strategic master seems odd. And then there's the structure of the actual cabinet, which, yeah, it's very difficult to say who won and lost in that entirely. I don't think that the DA came out of it as strongly as they would have wanted to. I don't think they got as many portfolios as they should just on the hard numbers. So I think on that front, possibly the ANC did do better than it should have. But on the other hand, it's kind of irrelevant, because the minute you introduce the ANC into the cabinet, that's what's losing for them. And you can have five portfolios or 10 portfolios. It's the fact that they're there and you have to share government with them. That's the problem. And I think everything the ANC is going to do from now on is going to be to try and not coerce, but kind of pressurize the DA into following a lot of prescripts that have already been determined. So, yeah, I really don't think Cyril Ramaphosa is a winner in any shape or form. Whether he can hold this all together, we need to see. But I mean, this is not the formula for success, if you ask me.
Except for the fact that Gareth, he remains the president. He is averted any kind of responsibility for those huge losses internally at the ANC and also within government, right? So he remains president. He remains the head of that cabinet. He remains the person who is in charge and in control to a large extent in terms of how he directs where everybody is going. And he has brought the DA. In fact, the way that I see it right now, the EFF, as much as we may not like their politics or what they say or how they say it, MK and the wrecking ball that they are have essentially become the opposition because the DA has gotten into bed with Cyril Ramaphosa. And we're at the beginning and watching over the past couple of days, so, you know, all the portfolio committees and who gets to be in what position in those portfolio committees is also a little bit of horse trading. And, you know, I was interested to see that Songhe Zozibi is now the chairperson of SCOPA. Interesting to see that Musi Maimane is the chairperson also of an accounting portfolio committee. And all of that for me really means that what should be the opposition and what should be the requisite tension sitting inside that parliament has been very muted. And Cyril Ramaphosa, and understand me, that I'm not saying that Cyril Ramaphosa has won for the ANC. I think he has won for himself. If you consider what his personal motivations are, they're not necessarily aligned to what we would like to see as a country, or even what the ANC would like to see as a governing party, even a much reduced governing party. But Cyril Ramaphosa has very firmly created for himself an environment within which he has survived being held accountable, whether it's for Palapala, whether it's for losing by such a huge margin for the ANC. He has positioned himself into a cushionable position where there's going to be nobody who's going to hold him accountable because he's holding the cards and he's horse trading with those cards. And his people have been rewarded. I mean, Jesus, Phemi Majodina, a minister. What? Aibo.
Yeah, look, I mean, it kind of depends on what your definition of winning is. And, you know, the ANC was very clear in what its goals were ahead of the election. It wanted 50%. In fact, Ramaphosa himself on multiple occasions, as he's done in elections before, said the ANC was well on track to win a national majority, a comfortable national majority. They were going to win in KZN. They were going to win in Gauteng. There are 100 quotes to this effect, you know, and they didn't, and they got smashed, and they lost 18% of their support under him. Now, that necessitates a different environment, so you therefore need a different set of criteria to determine what's winning and losing once the votes are in, because you can only work with what you've got. And I think on that front, you're right when you say that he has avoided any kind of internal party accountability, but there's a great risk to that. I mean, that was not because of some strategic brilliance on his part. It was simply necessity drove the fact that they had to form a government and they didn't have time for an internal party implosion or a vote against their president. So you can be sure there's a significant number of people in the ANC who are not happy with Ramaphosa and his performance. And all of that unhappiness has been repressed to be dealt with at a later date. And that is very dangerous for a political party. When you repress those kind of unhappiness feelings and don't give them an outlet, you don't give them a platform to be heard, to be explained, to be answered, they go away. People tend to factionalize. They mobilize around those grievances. And this can take time, can take 2 or 3 years to find an outlet. but it will find an outlet. And that is what Ramaphosa has done. He's basically, you know, I mean, if he was a psychological patient, he's repressed a lot of trauma. And it's going to come out somewhere. And yeah,
that's he's not coming back for a third term as the president of South Africa or the ANC. He's avoided the biggest part of it. He's avoided the embarrassment of being a single term president. But I'm also quite interested because I have been watching all of your Twitter rants about the EFF. Speaking of internal implosion and repression of unhappiness within an organization, and coming up in December is going to be the EFF's own, what do they call it? Their Congress, where they're voting for their next top six or seven or whoever they are. And they really are in a position now coming up in December where they have to reassert who's who in the zoo and who directs where the EFF goes to next. What do you foresee as you've been watching the EFF rather closely? What do you think is happening there? And they have also, you know, taken a hit in this election. Where do you see them going?
So the EFF is fascinating for me. I mean, on the one hand, they're incredibly frustrating because they, you know, deceive and lie and put out a lot of propaganda on Twitter. On the other hand, there's very little good analysis of why the EFF is behaving the way it did and also why its election results went bad. And so there's a kind of shortage of explanation as to why it is that the EFF is behaving so appallingly. And those two things lead to a kind of vacuum where the EFF is allowed to behave a certain way, but escapes any kind of, you know, public interrogation or consequences for its condition. Now, I think the EFF has got a fundamental existential problem. I mean, what's happened is it was born into an environment where it said the ANC under Jacob Zuma generally is failing the revolution. It's lost revolutionary flame. It's lost its direction. It's corrupt. And we are going to take up that flame. We're going to basically be an external ANC that is true to the liberation movement and the national democratic revolution. And we're going to teach the ANC how it's supposed to act. There's no market for that. I mean, they've been at it for 10 years now. They've declined by a point or so in this election. They're at 9.5%. Meanwhile, the ANC has imploded. Its voters dropped. It's completely factionalized. It now exists in three different parties. It's lost control of a range of provinces. That's just politically. You would have thought just in that environment alone, the EFF was able to capitalize, given its mandate and its purpose, its sole mandate and purpose. It hasn't. It's done appallingly. And then there's the environment more generally in which it operates, which is absolutely rife for revolution, as the EFF puts it. I mean, massive unemployment, massive distrust in state institutions, huge levels of crime, a massive desperation. I mean, you gave this environment to any other great revolutionary party, you know, from Lenin to Mao, they would grasp it with open hands. This is like perfect for revolution. Let's capitalize on it. They've done nothing. They can't capitalize on anything. They're the world's most useless revolutionary party. And what's happened
is it fair to say that these guys are mostly just performative? Like, the big problem with the EFF and even with MK is that they're based around a grievance. And the big problem with that is that revolutions have to have some kind of a vision. They have to have some plan for what will happen when they take over. There has to be some idea of what kinds of things will go right if they do end up in charge. And we've never heard any of that from EFF or from MK. The EFF exists because it was an angry part of the ANC that wasn't dealing well within the ANC with, you know, all the things that you've already mentioned. And MK is essentially just, you know, we're a pro-Zuma party. We're here to support the old man. We feel he was treated badly, and all the people in the party were treated badly with him. You know, the likes of John Hlophe and Tom Moyane and so on, Burning and Tlemeza Pums, our favorite. So they don't really have much purpose beyond that. They're not really revolutionary. They're just grievances.
Go, Gareth. Yes, and don't be unkind. The EFF is a government in waiting.
Yeah, well, you know, they've yet to get their hands on any government. I absolutely agree with you, Gareth. And the other problem is the revolution. I mean, what is the revolution? We don't know. For example, you know, there are quotes from the EFF saying the revolution is coming and we're warning you about it. There are endless quotes saying this is how we keep moving the revolution forward. And there are endless quotes saying, well, these people have been in the revolution, as Malema says, since he was 9 years old or something. So which is it? Is the revolution happened? Is it happening? Is it going to happen? What are its parameters? Where does it begin and end? What are its actual goals? And the best thing that EFF has got are these seven pillars of revolution, but they might as well be seven kind of constitutional pillars. They're largely meaningless. They're just policy things. You know, we want to have no corruption and we want to nationalize banks and stuff. Well, that's not a revolution. A revolution is you overturn the state's edifice, the fundamental edifice that is the state, and replace it with something else. There are no revolutionary definitions of what the EFF is, yet it constantly tells us it's in revolution. And I think what this election has done is it's initiated a crisis for the EFF, and that's why it's behaving the way it has. It has a relevance problem. It basically has lost a lot of credibility, and so its response to that is to just be hysterical on Twitter, which is all, you know, it's basically a Twitter revolutionary party, and to try and manufacture grounds for some fundamental difference between black people or white people or the poor and rich or, you know, Oppenheimer's and whatever funds the EFF. But, you know, Twitter's not going to deliver a revolution, and it's just kind of hilarious. It's, yeah.
Do you think that possibly what's not the a great reasons why... but do you think that possibly one of the reasons why we don't have much analysis of what's happening within the EFF, who the various people are, firstly because it is a cult of personality and it's the personality of Julius Malema, and secondly because one of the things that I've been incredibly fascinated to watch over the past couple of years is how he, Julius, has managed to create not just around himself, this cult within the party, but also with the way that he interacts with journalists and media as a whole, right? So they'll send out a notification that they're going to have a press briefing of some sort at Winnie Mandela House. And people arrive for that press briefing and it's just a gossip mongering session.
Yes.
Jack, I'm hearing myself back and it's a little bit delayed. I don't know what's with the sound issues at the moment.
No problem.
Did you hear that?
I mean, I did hear that, yeah. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, look, that's not particular to the EFF. I mean, if you look at this election, there were some fundamentally, historically significant results. The ANC, a party that's had 50% for however many centuries, dropped below 50%. The EFF, a want-to-be revolutionary party, declined in an environment rife for revolution. The MK, a brand new, you know, party, which is essentially a cult of personality in the exact same way the EFF, suddenly exploded and took over a whole province. Because of coalitions, which immediately captures the media's attention entirely, we have no analysis of what went wrong. Now, if this was, you know, America or the UK, you'd have a serious discussion. Look, these are where the ANC lost support amongst young people, amongst women, amongst people of a certain income. This is where the EFF went backwards and why. This is how its campaign didn't work. Its messages didn't resonate. This is, you know, why people chose Zuma over the EFF. There's just no attempt to analyze what happened in this election at all. We're just not interested. It's all about coalitions and the future. And I understand that stuff's important and you need to talk about it. But actually, quite important to understand what just happened, what delivered this coalition. And in hard data terms, there's absolutely nothing that you can point to. No one can explain it. I mean, one of the most interesting things for me is why did the EFF collapse in KwaZulu-Natal? I mean, that's a key position. And it's not good enough to just say because of the MK. People had a choice between how they want to screw the ANC over. Do they want to go with Malema or do they want to go with Zuma? And why is one brand stronger than the other? Why does one deliver that better than the other? And yeah, I think those are important questions.
Well,
to understand.
We've spoken about this quite extensively on this show. Hey, Garrett,
yeah.
We've spoken about
absolutely.
It. I mean, we saw that the EFF was going to be bludgeoned in KZN. Their messaging, we've spoken about it on this show and kind of felt that their messaging does not resonate. You know, a message of land in an environment where everybody has is land and watching the wind go by doesn't resonate if you're not giving them anything more than that, you know? So we saw that.
Gareth, this brings up something that I've wanted to talk to you about, and obviously we only...
Say something about Pumi quickly, just her comment, because I just think it's important. So you see, that's one of the problems, is I think you need to go deeper than that. I mean, I agree people saw that there was a problem with the EFF and MK, but it's pretty important to politics to understand why people make the choices they do. And to just say, oh, they wanted Zuma, that's not insightful enough. Because the fundamental choice that people are making there are a difference between essentially some kind of ideological worldview. I mean, yes, the EFF has a cult of personality thing, but it also has much more of a philosophy than MK does. And if people are willing to choose Zuma over any kind of principled choice, any kind of value, any kind of policy decision, because the MK has none, it only released its manifesto after the election, that is really important. There are 2.2 million people in KZN who will vote for a person. It doesn't matter what they stand for. And I think that's an important insight that needs to, you know, some publicity to be needed to understand why it is and who are these people, because that's quite a dangerous thing in democracy. Yeah, so anyway.
No, I think that's a very good point. Just briefly on what Pumi was saying too. I mean, you came under huge fire from certain quarters. I could have kind of predicted where they were coming from. And it seems to me like the battle lines were drawn as soon as the results started to pour in. You were making predictions as well. And I'm glad Pumi referred to her, not my. Pums, you deserve the credit for this one. Her prediction that the EFF was going to be in free fall. But I think that you also came under a lot of microscopic attention from people like Mighty Jamie, who's been on the show before, and some others, who said, oh, you completely got it wrong. I think it's only appropriate that we give you a chance to say, actually, you got it right, and to explain exactly where. And also to explain to us what the best response should be, perhaps, to those people who are living in a parallel universe where they just don't see the numbers that we see for some reason.
Well, it's a complicated problem, Gareth. I mean, the one is that, you know, the advent of social media means things like market research is personalized. So it does become, to a large degree, about me, and people think it's me saying this stuff, but it's not me. I run a company and we do market research. We ask people, registered voters, what they think. And then we just publish those numbers. And this inability to, you know, and it's fueled by all the things that I'm sure you and everyone else is used to, conspiracy and political bias and propaganda. But the inability to be able to separate the person who delivers the news from the actual nature of the news is pretty profound. And, you know, the vast number of people project how they feel about you onto the data. So, you know, because they don't like you, therefore you must have manipulated the data or shaped it in a certain way. Now, the fundamental problem with that in market research is, you know, if you are wrong, that's really bad for business. You can't have a business model where you manipulate data so it suits. You can do it once and that'll be it. No one will ever work with you again. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, assuming that a bank wants to lose your money so that it can get more investing from you. It's like, what the, there's no kind of business model. And so it's just remarkable that people would make an assumption that you want to self-destruct yourself for the sake of, I don't know, a few retweets. But people believe this powerfully and strongly. They refuse to engage with the methodology or the data or learn anything about it. I mean, if they come from a place of total ignorance, they know nothing about how market research works, the massive amount of stats and programming and coding that goes into getting a representative result. Yeah, it just boils down to ignorance at the end of the day.
All right.
although some of that data, when it came out, I will not lie, I was flabbergasted when the first polls came out that said that the EFF, that the ANC would be below 50.
Yeah.
That
happens to us too. I mean, that poll that we did for the SRF. Sorry to interrupt. That happens to us too. That poll that we did for the SRF, where it put the MK on 20 or something in KZN, was the first poll that showed these guys are really big in KZN. We were like, oh shit, is there something fundamentally wrong here? Have we missed something? Have we fucked something up? We ran that banner book, the data book that produces the result, like 3 times to make sure, because you don't even trust it yourself. It's like, this goes against everything I think. And then at a certain point, once you've checked all the data and you've checked the numbers and the maths, you have to say, this is what people say. This is, yeah.
I think one of the things that I would like to hear your opinion on as well is, as we've been watching, and a couple of days ago when the JSC was put together, it's interesting to see the kinds of people that MK is now fielding and where they are positioning these people. A week ago, they had their own kind of internal lekhotla, I think, in the Limpopo. And suddenly we saw coming out of the woodworks, the Tom Moyanes, the, Lucky Montana, Siyabonga Gama. These are individuals that went off in shame around when Zondo was out, and we haven't seen or heard from them in a very long time. And all of a sudden, they surface at this big party, this big political party gathering, where they are now reshuffling who they are deploying where. And what do you make of this that we're watching unfold?
Yeah, well, I mean, MK is a grievance party. And, you know, at the center, they have the world's biggest professional victim who has never made a bad decision in his life, and the whole world has constantly conspired to misrepresent and undermine him, and he's just, you know, basically misrepresented and misunderstood. He is surrounded by everyone who he believes suffered from that conspiracy against him. Everyone that he put, which in his mind, into positions of power, or he backed politically, or he supported, and who was thrown out by, you know, these terrible people in the ANC who, you know, controlled by the Oppenheimers or whatever. And now's his chance to pay those people back. And so, I mean, it's interesting if you compare MK to the EFF. You know, the EFF seems on some level, well, it's hard to tell when, but it seems to have a genuine interest in either controlling the ANC externally or eventually merging with the ANC and reintegrating into it on different terms, on the EFF's terms. MK seems set on never working with the ANC again. I mean, everyone that the ANC has thrown out that has been proven to be corrupt or, you know, unethical, it is mobilizing around. And that is there's no way the ANC is going to welcome those people back. It got rid of them all. So MK seems to have zero interest. It just wants to cause trouble for the ANC. It doesn't have any interest, I think, in working with that party or reintegrating back into it.
And I think the interesting dynamic that it is now really opening up in the conversation for South Africans in how our institutions are protected is also, I mean, what do you do now with a person like Dr. John Hlophe, who has been impeached in a particular environment, and now he is an MP and he's going to be part of the people who decide, who become the judges? You know, when that very parliament decided that he was not fit for that bench, and now he's going to be part of the decision makers, and then watching everybody as they themselves, you know, Musi Maimane was quite like vocal tweeting about this over the past couple of days, as they themselves are having the cognitive dissonance that says, what do we do now? What do we do now when this individual has been part of a party political system that has voted him into the seat? And because he is part of the house, he is eligible to be part of this. And he has on paper, he has all the credentials, right? He's got the masters, he's got the, in fact, possibly one of the most qualified individuals to be in that seat. But we have an ethical dilemma with that individual. And now we're kind of going, now what?
Yeah, I cannot tell you how much this fucking irritates me and how significant I think it is. This Clope thing, I think, is a massive moment. Mm. You know, because this is South Africa, the first test of the new parliament arrived within about 48 hours. You'd probably have to wait in a new place. But this was big, and Clope is big. I mean, that guy is fundamentally problematic. He's a fundamentally race-driven narcissist and an unethical, dangerous person. And he's certainly no one that you can have on a JSE, on the JSC. And this obsession with, you know, the rules allow him to be on it is just mad. All these parties, by the way, when the rules allow for ministers to have a BMW or have a house or something, the big problem with the rules. These rules are very problematic. Ministers are unethical. How dare you have a $2 million car because the rules allow it? Now the rules allow for John Clope. The rules allow. We must respect the rules, and we can deal with this at a later stage, the ANC says. This inability to separate your ethics from bureaucracy is astounding in South Africa. And it's because we're a process outcome, a country, not an outcomes driven thing. And processes determine all ethics. It's shocking.
I just want to throw in there, because something else you've got involved in the last couple of days is this ridiculous idea that if someone's qualified for something, they've got a degree, for example, that immediately invalidates any ethical or moral questions. It's more important that you're qualified in something. And this has been pushed largely by the EFF, is that, you know, this one has a degree, that one doesn't. Therefore, this one is superior morally, ethically, and otherwise. I mean, this is very stupid. And it's only happened since the EFF's upper echelons have got their own degrees. Before that, they were totally against this. They said, absolutely fine if we have an uneducated president. Remember?
Yes. Look, one must separate the general truth, I think, from the exception. I mean, I think as a general rule, it is good and healthy to have education and have people who are qualified. And that is a healthy norm to establish in society and one that should be encouraged. But the general rule does not disprove the exception. It is quite possible to have people that are really good who don't have a formal degree. And you need to do this assessment on a case-by-case basis, preferably before the person is appointed and based on their performance in other areas. But it is absolutely not set in stone that someone who does not have, you know, a university degree or whatever the case may be, is not really good at being a politician or a minister or something that essentially has political choice and political decision-making at its heart, as opposed to being a director general, which has strategic thinking and, you know, you need qualifications and understanding and depth to be able to run that. There's no course in the world that teaches politics. And it's why you often get brilliant politicians who don't have formal degrees. So you need to run this stuff on a case-by-case basis in politics. You can't enforce this universe of academia onto it. It doesn't work like that.
How are we going to build this meritocracy and a capable state without like education, guys?
Well, it drives me crazy that there isn't any ethical dimension to this. I mean, we've got people who, you mentioned them just now, Pumi. You mentioned Lucky Montana. You mentioned, I mentioned Burning in Tlemeza. We've got John Clope. I mean, these are people who have been found wanting, not only in terms of actually following the rules that they now use to claim that they have a seat in parliament and they can get on some committee. But these are the people who've shown that they don't care about anything to do with good or bad. To them, all of that is negotiable. And I'm afraid that's like an effect of the left, if you ask me. I mean, I'm throwing in some opinions, some wild and dangerous opinion of my own here. But it's always on the left that these things become, well, it's an issue of nomenclature or definition. And you can almost hear people redefining things in their own heads when it comes to this stuff. If it suits them, the old definition applies. If it doesn't, we must redefine the parameters of what this word, you know, bad or good or criminal actually means.
No, I think that's absolutely right, Gareth. I think they do have a grand moral code, which is essentially determined by race. But, you know, certainly the kind of constitutional or democratic value set that, or principle set that you would think would accompany a standard democracy do not apply. And, I mean, it's best evidenced by Clope. You know, the stuff that Dalian Porfu is saying on Twitter is essentially that this man was harassed out of his position by racists. It was the ANC, you know, the ANC majority was fundamentally getting rid of Clope. So it's just fundamentally not true. But that determines morality. That they redefine the problem as a racial problem, which is false. He was evicted because he was black. And that they can even do this when the majority of the judiciary is black, when the parliamentary majority is black, when all other constitutional court judges and high court judges, or at least a vast majority of them, are black. Anyway, this is an example of racism, and that defines the whole parameter. It defines morality. It defines what's good and bad, and we'll just reinterpret the universe through this lens, which is detached from reality.
I think I think this, and Gareth, unfortunately, I don't think it's a left or right problem. I think it's neither left or right. I think it's on this continuum where we now live in a society that is very happy to redefine things in terms of what works for them versus what works for the other. And, you know, unfortunately, we also don't have enough systems that hold each other accountable now, because we are shouting each other down, whether it's on social media, whether it's on, you know, we just have too many opportunities to shut down a conversation if we don't like it, right? So that's one of the things.
I mean, let's have a little bit of fun here, because, you know, Gareth is so outspoken on social media, and whether or not any of us agree with him, I encourage you to follow him, just because there's some really interesting. I like it when you do a whole thread, you know, like when there's 20 different comments about some particular issue where you've actually gone into it and found the history. I always think that that's really useful, because, I mean, your own history is of being hugely critical of the DA, but people now think you're a DA puppet of some kind. It's like people just assume Pumi is anti-DA just because she says one thing in one episode 6 episodes ago. Either way, I'm interested in what you think of our cabinet ministers, who you are looking forward to seeing in action. And we've got to talk. I mean, the star of the show already within a few days is Gayton McKenzie. He seems to be taking it extremely seriously. A lot of what he does is crowd-pleasing, and I think that's okay, because that's what we've had with Fikile Mbalula and many others before. I just think Gayton might actually get some stuff done, only because he's like a bull in a china shop, right? But what do you think of him? And then we can go through some of the others who you might be watching more closely.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's start with McKenzie. I mean, the guy is a populist per excellence. So as you say, he's made a big splash and made a number of things that are, you know, have certainly got people talking about his position in sports and arts and culture. So from a political perspective, he's using that platform very effectively. And by the way, very clever and very important from him. I mean, one of, you know, the thing about the PA and one of the things that market research shows is that it's intricately linked, as a lot of these personality cult parties are, and the PA is Gayton McKenzie or bust, to the performance of the leader and his brand. When McKenzie's brand goes up, the PA's vote goes up. And one of the PA's problems is that he's just not that well known. I mean, he had a very low favorability of around 12% in the election. And that was just because, you know, a huge proportion of the population, around 60% of registered voters, didn't know who he was. I mean, it was bigger in the Western Cape, but elsewhere, nowhere. And this thing will deliver him into a lot more households. And, you know, he just needs to hit 1 out of 10 for the PA to be able to get to 10%. And there's nothing that delivers that more than the publicity that comes out of being an official minister in cabinet. So I think, as far as the actual administration of the department goes, I suspect he's really fucked off a lot of those departmental officials by, you know, demanding lists be released and stuff like that. And so I don't think he gives a damn about building some kind of internal chaos in the Department of Sports and Culture. He just wants to use it for publicity, but yeah, highly effective so far at that.
What do you think of Dean McPherson and his 300 million rand statement?
Yeah, I think the DA is trying to do the same kind of thing to a degree, obviously trying to be a bit more reasonable about it and less populist. But, you know, it's really important politically to obviously make the kind of impact that Mackenzie's made in the first days as best as you can without, you know, making a department, internal department, really angry with you, but also showing that you're doing things and having an impact. But I think that's a secondary concern to the DA's fundamental problem, which is that all of its ministers, all of its new ministers and deputy ministers are untested in government. Now, I think there's a lot of talent there. I think a lot of those people have raw talent. But, I mean, it is remarkable that a party that has people who've been in government for 10 years in the Western Cape, who have real experience, have not made a plan for any of these people to be in a position to be able to take up national seats. And that you would have your first six ministers are freshmen or fresh women, as the case may be. And, I mean, that is just astounding. Now, that's not to say those people can't learn, and some of them I think can excel. I think there's some really good people in there. But, I mean, you spend the first 5 years of any term learning the ropes. And I don't know if the government or the DA can afford that kind of time. And it's just remarkable to me that not a single person has been in government before. I mean, that's a real special, brave approach from the DA, and hopefully it's the right one.
And what about, you know, we've got, because it is a GNU after all, we've got the IFP in there with their own ministers and deputy ministers. What do you think of those two at COGTA?
Well, I think the IFP's approach to government in KZN and nationally has always been a different approach to opposition parties, essentially, who fundamentally need government to be able to drive their brand. The IFP has no real interest in any support outside of KZN. It tends to follow rather than lead inside government. So it relies on its officials and people in the departments to run it, but it doesn't run portfolios publicly in the way that other parties do. You know, they're all about constant information and transparency and demonstrating progress and being able to build public faith through, you know, talking to people. The IFP is more like, this is a process, this is a bureaucracy, I know my place in the system and I will do what's necessary, but I'm not, you know, I'm not putting out a press statement every 5 minutes. So it's hard to gauge what happens in IFP portfolios because they're almost never in the public eye. And yeah, it all happens behind the scenes.
Maybe less attention seeking and more effective. Certainly, I hope so in the case of COGTA.
Yes, that's a very important department and a critical department ahead of the local government elections. I mean, you can have a real influence there. If Gayton Mackenzie was on COGTA, he could really have a big influence ahead of the local government elections in 2 years. So it's going to be fascinating to see what the IFP does with this.
And what about the shuffle that has happened within the ANC itself? You know, some of those ministers who were there before, who looked immovable, haven't come back. Pravin Gordhan, Begicele, Naledi Pando. You know, there have been quite a lot of shifts even in the ANC cabinet, as it were. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so the test of the ANC, as ever, is really about the mechanics of government. I mean, doesn't matter who the ANC puts in, there's going to be no fundamental policy shift because that's not the way the ANC works, and it's governed by, you know, democratic centralism, and these things are predetermined. You're basically just a minister to implement what party policy is to the letter. And there's no room for independence or scope. So the question about any ANC minister is really a question about how effective, transparent, and uncorrupt you are in implementing that agenda. And that's the test of any ANC minister. Can you do this without stealing money or fucking things up? And so there were a lot of people that could not do that and did steal a lot of money and were fundamentally incompetent. And this new batch, well, we'll see. I think it's going to be more difficult to be incompetent in a GNU. It's one of the benefits of competition and why liberals in general are big on competition. because you get shown up very quickly. And, you know, the DA, for example, has a fundamentally different attitude to government, which is all about talking what you're doing and keeping people informed all the time and demonstrating progress. The ANC's approach is to wait for an election and then tell you 2 months before we've changed the world, but nothing in between. And, yeah, that competition might well force ANC ministers to up their game.
This raises an important question, and I'd like both your and Pumi's thoughts on this, because I spoke to somebody a couple of days ago who is an advisor inside of cabinet to one of the ministries. And this person told me they have been for the last 4 or 5 years, so it's not as if they've just come in now. They said that cabinet works like this. They have a meeting. Everybody reads their prepared. First of all, the president goes on and he speaks for about 40 minutes about what the agenda is, what kinds of things he wants to get done, blah, blah, blah. And then each of the ministers reads their prepared statement, often prepared by their staff or their advisors. And then that's the meeting. There's not really much of a discussion. There isn't much of a to and fro. That's how it happens. And then they all go off and do their thing. And in another month, or perhaps even longer a period in between, they get together and do the same thing again. And we all seem to think that this is like how a company runs. You know, everybody gets into the room at executive level. They all talk about what they need to do. Oh, I'll help you there. Can you do this for me? Blah, blah, blah. And they all try to kind of negotiate their way through how to overcome problems. This doesn't happen in cabinet. So if that's the way it works, and I have no reason to think that this person is misleading me, then essentially each of the departments kind of works as a silo. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, so that is an important question, Gareth. And one of the problems with this negotiation and all this analysis of, you know, Cyril is a mastermind and stuff, is that it's not over. People don't understand how the negotiation for the GNU works. It actually comprises four phases. Phase number one is an in-principle agreement, and that was the first thing that was decided, and obviously that's very important because it says both sides, within this broad set of principles and values, is committed to working together. Phase two is working out who gets what positions, and that phase is also done. And these are legitimate phases that are, you know, the DA and the ANC have put out there in the public domain. This is literally how the GNU negotiation is structured. I'm not making this up or imposing my own things. Phase three and phase four, which are to do with government, an agreed upon policy program and government mechanisms to implement that program, have not yet been decided. They are still being negotiated by those teams. And I mean, this is critical. This thing can still fall apart based on phases three and four. And phase three, which is government mechanisms, is fundamentally critical. I mean, one of the things that the DA wants, for example, is a mechanism outside of cabinet to deal with grievances so that parties can arrive with, you know, differing policy positions or proposals. They can have a discussion before cabinet, work out what is the best outcome that suits both sides that can be taken to cabinet, so cabinet doesn't become a massive fight over, you know, how these things work. And there's a grievance mechanism outside of cabinet. But I imagine the way in which cabinet runs will also be addressed in those kind of policy and principle discussions. And, yeah, it's going to have fundamental implications for how something like cabinet works. And things are going to be different to usual. I mean, I don't think they can run the model that you set out. You know, people are going to have views on what other people's policies are and so on and so forth, and appointments.
So, Gareth, this is the thing that I said last week, that they've put the, you know, the cart before the horse, because actually what Gareth is laying out as phase three and phase four is what should have led the discussion that says who gets what. Because first you say, these are the things that need to be achieved. We spoke about this a little bit with Mr. Mwelizibeki as well. Is first you go, what are we trying to fix? What is the problem? What are we trying to fix? And what do we need to do to fix the problem? And who is going to do what towards fixing that problem? But these guys first started by saying, what position can I get? And how many of those positions can I get? We can't hear you, Gareth.
It's like you're dishing out the spoils before the war, you know? It's like, and most people in South African society look at this and they go, this is just a feeding frenzy of politicians to try and occupy positions. That's what it looks like. And it may very well be the case for many of them.
But Gareth, you know, so on the issue of how these cabinet lekhotlas are supposed to work, the departments have interdependencies, right? So over and above the fact that these are the policies that they're driving and this is what they're doing with those policies, they have interdependencies and they should be working together anyway. And what the cabinet lekhotla is about is it's really just a catch up. It's supposed to be, if you were to use the analogy of a business, it's a catch up. It's your, I think they have it like every 6 weeks or something like that. And you'll see that they will actually put out a note. They'll put out a note tomorrow at the end of the lekhotla that will tell you all of the various things that were discussed, the agenda items, who said what, and all of that kind of stuff. It's supposed to be a, now that we're all together in the room, this is what has been happening. But they, because of the interdependencies, they should be working together anyway, every day anyway, because of the way that the various aspects of it. It's like a, you know, it's like a chain with links. It's not really supposed to be. Yeah, but right. you know.
Sorry, let me just say something that I think speaks to both of your observations. I actually agree with the way in which negotiations are structured. I think you do have to have the positions first, because it's a bit of a false assumption that the policy only follows later. But what I mean by the policy phase is it's not like you want to have a negotiation of an actual policy. I mean, the DA is there to implement what it believes in as far as possible in the portfolios it's responsible for. The point is you need to be able to have a system whereby, as Pumi says, these things can be achieved because, you know, government is integrated, and to achieve anything in one portfolio, you often need the help of Treasury, you need the help of the public service, you need the help of various departments to get it done. And so you need a system whereby other departments agree to work with you, even if they're not run by DA ministers, and vice versa. The DA departments will help the ANC implement its policy and its agendas, and that's quite hard to structure in a coherent way. But I think it's really important to have a government first, because a lot of policy decisions are also determined by who's in what portfolio. You know, you can't, the DA is obviously going to have massive emphasis on the six portfolios it is now governing. If you had to determine all policies before in the hope that maybe you'd get one, I mean, that's just an exercise that's endless. I think you need focus, and then you need to work out how to make it work in that portfolio.
I have one last question because we've got to wrap this up. Unfortunately, how will we measure performance? Is there a standard way for us to be able, because this is going to be, this is critical, especially to the DA who believe in a capable state, right? So all of their ministers are going to try to tick boxes so that they can show progress. How do we evaluate how good a minister is? Because the minister isn't the person who's implementing policy very often. I mean, they might execute at a very high level and tell the minions to go out and do whatever they've said they need to do. But how do we know? Because, for example, the Minister of Health may be measured on how well public hospitals work, but the Minister of Public Works is a much more complicated animal to deal with because he's got government leases on buildings and, you know, making sure that ministerial handbooks are followed with respect to housing for ministers and things like that. Each department is so... it's so complicated, right? I mean, there's no surefire way you could say, as the newspapers used to do back in the day, A+ for this minister, C- for that minister. It's very, very difficult to actually ascertain what level of competence they're operating at.
No, it's a great question. And one of the problems is that there are too many ways currently to evaluate ministers. I mean, for example, there's the minister in the presidency who has a formal kind of monitoring and evaluation program, which is largely behind the scenes. We don't know what it contains and how it works. There are party political assessments. So each party assesses its own candidate on its own terms and has its own expectations of what constitutes a good minister. There are public expectations and there are policy goals, KPIs set out in performance reviews, in performance plans and annual reports. And between these, you know, endlessly communicated, loud, different criteria, a member of the public needs to determine whether or not a minister is delivering. So I, at the end of the day, I think it is one of each. In other words, you need to deliver on your KPIs as agreed to in your performance plan and government. You need to represent your party well and uphold the party's mission and values and state and principles in government. And you need to perform well in government as a whole. You need to be able to operate within the parameters of that government, work well with other ministers in government, and generate a kind of general culture of delivery at a macro level. So, I mean, those are three of the big criteria I would use, and I'd ignore all the formal independent assessments.
Yeah.
last word is yours, Pums.
But that is precisely why we have elections and electioneering, because it's supposed to give us the scorecard. We are supposed to say, these are the boxes. You know, you promised A, B, and C, and you delivered on this. But now where we're sitting, because no one's telling us what is it that they, which is part of the reason why I feel like what they needed to work out first is what are the most critical aspects that they as a government of national unity are going to be delivering on and working on, and then tell us that, and then tell us who's going to be responsible for what part of that thing. But hey,
I mean, for the Minister of Women, Children and Those with Disabilities, can you imagine? They release 5 statements in a year. They think they've done their job.
It's all bad when Mama Joy is not going to the Olympics. It's all bad.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so you've actually got to be careful as a minister what you promise, because anything you promise, you'll be held to. And if you just shut up and promise nothing, you'll be held to nothing. It's great.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and a lot of people have adopted that model very successfully.
Yeah. That's what incompetent people do. They learn to shut up and just take the salary.
Interesting how all of this is going to play out, because we're now in the next election cycle, right? Going into local elections. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see who gets punished for the decisions that they've made in terms of acquiescing and taking the votes that they've been entrusted with and giving them back to.
And we will be watching. We'll be watching all the work from the Social Research Foundation with Gareth in great detail and with great interest over the next couple of years as you continue to deliver useful information to the people of South Africa, and especially those who thought that you were completely out of your mind when you started publishing some of those results from your polling. But I love seeing what you get up to on social media. That's one of the most fun things to do. So if you don't follow Gareth, we will post all of his links in the description below. And also, just so you know, the Burning Platform is now available on the Podcast Party SA YouTube channel, which you're probably watching us on now, or else I don't know how you're getting this right. Also, all the usual podcast apps like Apple, Spotify, but look for the Podcast Party account and subscribe there. African Analysis with JJ Cornish is also under the Podcast Party now. All you need to know at podcastparty.co.za. Thank you to Pumi Mashiko. Thank you to Gareth van Onselen. Most especially, thank you to you. We'll see you next week for more.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Gareth.